we're on to the next topic now, developing bodhicitta. So that's the good thing about this course, that it's 10 classes, which is quite a long course actually, but it can be just a drop into introduction to Buddhism. Each night's a different topic, and I attempt the impossible, which is to cover everything of importance of that one topic in one night. So my name's Miffy, and I've been here just about forever. I don't know, like 29 years. Started off as a two-month plan and kind of blew out from there. So you can never quite tell how your life is going to turn out. We've been going through various different topics of what is Buddhism, what's the purpose of meditation, which is basically about being able to care for our mind, the inner life. A Buddhist is being an inner being. We've looked at then the nature of our mind, and from a Buddhist point of view, how the nature of our mind, in fact, the nature of all living beings, mind, a being, you know, has a mind, is clean and clear and pure by nature, and that it's all of the kind of our innate ignorance and disturbing emotions and emotional baggage and everything that gets tossed into that mind, but it's like layers, and those, they're what's called adventitious. All of those negativities can be removed, and that is kind of good to know, because then when you look at the work of doing it, you need some hope that it is actually possible, but by nature it's possible. So then we've also looked at a little bit about karma, karmic cause and effect, which is internal cause and effect. How cause and effect works in our mind, in our emotions, in our experiences, and how to put that together to understand our life and why things happen to us, and more importantly, what we can do about them. Because karma isn't a fatalistic thing. Karma, actually, understanding karma means we can take some control over our life and what happens to us. And then last week we looked at the other really important topic, which is death and dying, because what determines our next rebirth, one is karma, and two is the state of our mind when we're dying. You know, where we end up if we die with an agitated mind is very different from where we end up if we die with a peaceful mind without regrets. So for those of you that were here last week or who managed to catch up on the video last week, any comments or questions? I know you were saying just before we started about being a paramedic and being able to tell whether... Yeah, because the signs are more subtle. So the vital signs might be, you know, the breathing stop, pulse, heart, whatever. But if the consciousness is still there, if you're very familiar with it as a paramedic, you could tell, yes, there's still someone there. And when body and mind are separated, that's it. It's done. Doesn't matter what you try.
It sounds good.
It is subjective, though.
Subjective.
Because it's not a physical thing. That's why. So with work of a paramedic, it's based on the physicality of it. But we're a body and mind, and so as body and mind separate, it goes on to a much more subtle level of what's happening with the mind. So you can't measure it physically, or it's tricky too. There is actually a project in India that His Holiness the Dalai Lama and a couple of hospitals there have set up to try and record what happens to great meditators when they die, because, you know, the body can be there without decomposing for days and days. But of course, when a great meditator is dying, how do you take them to the hospital or hook them up to the machines? And so when that's been happening, the machines haven't been available, or then the machines have been available, but no great meditator is dying. But in the last few years, there has been an opportunity for this, and then all the doctors have been completely confounded, because 10 days later the body's still fresh, there's still brain waves, but there's no breath and no pulse and no heart. So that's and of course it just doesn't fit into the medical paradigm, but there it is in the data. So it's just kind of there on the table, and then it's pushed away as an embarrassment. But for us, I mean, it kind of, we can see how it makes sense. Yeah, like you said, if you're very close to the person, or if you're familiar with seeing people die, then you can tell. You can tell. It's either a shell or they're still there. Yeah. I know there's so much fear and a lot of feeling of it's kind of this superstition that if we talk about death, it will bring it on. And really, yeah, it's something to very gently, gently, and just, I mean, gallows humor goes a long way as well, doesn't it? Amanda was telling me last week too, after we finished the class, one of the fellows that was here had managed to come along that night because his work had been cancelled because somebody had died. But he didn't say that in the class because it was like the exact demonstration of how we don't know when it's going to happen. There's a probability, you know, that we'll live to an X amount age, but we can't definitively say, and so that changes things. Anyway, there's always many questions that come up from these, and I'm really glad that there are. So just keep the questions percolating around, and I'm always happy to have midnight emails about it too. So what we're going to follow on now with tonight's class is what's called bodhicitta, developing the bodhicitta attitude. So what we've been talking about is kind of what's in general with on the Buddhist path, but we're a Mahayana center. So Mahayana is a particular tradition of Buddhism that is like the universal goal of including the welfare and well-being of every single living being. And the aim to bring everybody to enlightenment. So it's a really big goal, this bodhicitta attitude. So this is unique to the Mahayana, the universal vehicle. When you hear about bodhicitta, it can be a bit overwhelming. So when I first heard about bodhicitta was growing up as a Buddhist, because my mother started this center and was a Buddhist and devoted to Lama Tsogchen Rinpoche, and she would tell me about bodhicitta of becoming a bodhisattva and liberating every single living being from suffering and leading them to a state of lasting happiness. And I'm like, oh my God, what can I do? I'm only six. And I'm like, oh, okay. Because I was a very serious child and like I felt it as a quite overwhelming. But that's of course because I hadn't been introduced to it. I hadn't had the study of how to have this in a context because actually it's not a burden, it's something that really motivates you. It's the exact opposite of a burden. So in this class, I'm trying to fill in the gaps so that you don't experience like I did as an overwhelmed 6-year-old, serious sixer. What we can all do though is the foundation of equanimity, because bodhicitta is based on this foundation of an equal affection for all. And we can just see where, when we have all the differences in the world, the partiality and bias that we have, that's really what creates a lot of conflict. So, equanimity is the minimum we can do as a human being and our contribution to the world. And so, then also, we'll look at the actual step-by-step process to develop bodhicitta, because it doesn't mean you just sit there going, bodhicitta, bodhicitta, bodhicitta. There is a natural process where if you go through the steps, you naturally come up with the result of a bodhicitta attitude. There's actually different methods, and I'll just share one of them with you tonight. So let's take a moment to set our motivation. We get settled in our posture, our body, feeling comfortable in our own skin. Feeling supported by the chair. Happy to be here in this room and have set aside the busyness of the life for a moment. And bringing your focus inwards just to rest on the breath. letting the body breathe itself. You don't have to control the breath in any way, just become aware of it. And at the beginning of our classes, we often try and set an altruistic motivation. So by developing an altruistic heart, this wish to benefit others, the first beneficiary is actually ourselves. When we try and develop compassion, the first beneficiary is ourselves, as well as everybody else around us. So we can set our intention that we can devote our lives to making the world more peaceful, more kind, through offering service to other sentient beings, repaying their kindness. And if we developed our altruistic intention all the way, it would become a bodhicitta intention. This wish to alleviate the suffering of all living beings. And not just that, but to bring them to a state of lasting happiness so they don't fall back down again. So let your intention be informed by this vision of possibility. And then take a nice deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. So this is from Introduction to Tantra, A Vision of Totality by Lama Yeshe, who's one of the founders of this center. And so he says, we shouldn't think of bodhicitta as a religious attitude, something we have to believe in or accept on faith alone. This supremely compassionate outlook is a direct result of clear insight into our own reality and the reality of others. Whenever we're concerned with just ourselves, our own problems seem insurmountable. Preoccupied with thoughts of me, our mind is filled with worry and anxiety. Maybe I'm not good looking enough. Maybe others won't like me. I wonder if I'll succeed, and so on. Everything related to this I becomes a problem, a worry, a threat to our own well-being and security. The only way to break free from this neurotic obsession with ourselves is by opening our hearts to others. Actually, Venerable Rabina has often said that we can tell that it's an affliction, an afflicted state of mind, because it's neurotic. Meaning if we find that we are becoming neurotic, it's one of the afflictions dominating us. So when we're truly concerned with the welfare of someone else, we automatically cease to be so concerned with our own problems, at least for a while. And as compassion for others replaces pity for ourselves, we discover hidden treasures of strength and wisdom within us. It can be said that merely possessing this compassionate bodhicitta attitude is a type of enlightened experience. As we create this open space in our consciousness, we take on a much more universal character. Instead of being confined in our own petty reality, we move into the larger sphere of universal concern, and this automatically liberates us from most of our problems. So that's the big picture. And so in a way, bodhicitta we can think of as like the biggest, best possible attitude we could possibly have. So the most eco attitude, the most socially informed, engaged attitude, the most civil attitude, everything, the very biggest. And so the term bodhicitta, bodhi meaning enlightened, bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment. This and what we can think of it is an altruistic attitude that's informed by wisdom. So it's not, as Lama Yeshe often called it, idiot compassion. It's not just a feeling. It's informed by an understanding of our reality and others' reality. It's unique to Mahayana Buddhism, and really why it's so important is because if we want world peace, which we all want, we have to start with ourselves. We can't start by forcing somebody else to be peaceful. It just doesn't work that way. And we can't be angry about there's no world peace. I mean, even here we have people coming to our Buddhist classes who go off to various demonstrations. I'm so angry because I don't see any Buddhists there. And I'm like, well, number one, how's that anger going? And number two, what does a Buddhist look like? How can you tell if someone's a Buddhist? Look around. Would you be able to tell? No way. So, really, we have to be the advocates and start with a peaceful heart and then radiate that out. It's the only way for it to be effective. Then all the social work that we do has a chance of actually working. If we, whatever we do, if we do with a bodhicitta attitude, because of that altruistic attitude, it continuously benefits others. It doesn't matter what we're doing. We can have a really menial job, and suddenly, instead of it just being, oh, I'm a nothing, I'm just a housekeeper, or I'm just a checkout chick, it becomes meaningful because of that attitude. Important because not everybody can have a fantastically meaningful job and go out and save the world. Like many of us are just stuck in just boring, menial nothing or something but underappreciated. So, with this attitude, everything that we do becomes beneficial, and as a result, our own life becomes enriched and happier, our own heart calmer. And the whole thing is based on equanimity. Because, as we'll see later on, if we just have, even if we have a good-hearted attitude, if it's partial, if it's a bit prejudiced, if it's just my people and not your people, we're going to run into a lot of trouble. It's not sustainable. So far, so good. Any questions? I know we're kind of getting into the territory of like Buddhist terminology and jargon, so I don't want you to get left behind with that. So, how are we going? So, the opposite of bodhicitta is kind of called, I suppose, bodhicitta is this cherishing others, this idea of cherishing others. And the opposite of cherishing others isn't just being selfish. Or being up yourself, or it's actually being indifferent to others. So it's not necessarily an overt thing. So here's a little bit more from Lama Yeshe. So as long as we remain obsessively concerned with our own happiness alone, we will never experience the supreme happiness of a fully enlightened mind. In other words, if we wish to reach the highest possible destination, we must cultivate the highest possible motivation for following a spiritual path. And in Buddhist terminology, this supreme motivation is known as bodhicitta. The impulse to achieve full enlightenment, bodhi or Buddhahood, in order to be of the most benefit to others. Only through dedicating ourselves to working for the happiness of all beings, in other words, only by cultivating the open heart of bodhicitta, can we ever experience supreme happiness ourselves. So, as the Dalai Lama said, if you're going to be selfish, at least be wisely selfish. So, what he means by this peculiar sounding advice is that in a way, bodhicitta is like a huge selfish attitude. When you dedicate yourself to others with loving kindness, you get back far more happiness than you could ever experience otherwise. Ordinarily, we get so little happiness and it's easily lost. So, if we want to be as happy as possible, the only thing to do is dedicate ourselves wholeheartedly to the welfare of others. So I like this idea of intelligent selfishness because it's taken me a while. I mean, people have said, be kind and compassionate. I'm like, why? Convince me. And so I need to get the really big picture, and this is what gives it to me. So this intelligent selfishness, we've got two things. We've got what's called self-cherishing and what's called cherishing others. So self-cherishing is this indifference to others. And when we are neglectful or indifferent to others, what happens is there's nothing stopping us harming other people because we don't even know they're there. We just like run roughshod over them. So this is different from, it doesn't mean you neglect your own health or welfare. It doesn't mean that you run yourself ragged, but it's just when we don't notice others, when we're neglectful of them, then it's very easy to harm them without even noticing. There's nothing stopping us retaliating. And then when we do retaliate, so I was thinking, for example, if you're in traffic and someone cuts you off in traffic and you give them the finger, it doesn't matter because they're a stranger. So what if, as you go past that car, you look in and, oh my God, it's your grandma? So if you knew, you never would have done that. So this is the thing, because we have indifference, it's just a stranger, they don't matter. There's nothing stopping us retaliating. And so then it opens the door to all the negative actions that we do. And when we do negative actions, we harm others and we create karma, which means we'll be harmed in the future as well. So it's just wall-to-wall suffering. So, if we wind it back, we can see that the reason we harm others is because there's nothing stopping us from harming them. And the reason nothing's stopping us is because we don't care about them. You might have to turn me up. Just a, I'm headset number two. Or, yeah. And so the thing is that we've been acting out of what's called self-cherishing since forever, not even just this life, but beginningless lifetime. So it's a really big habit. It's an instinctual kind of impetus that we have. And that's why we're still stuck and circling around and why we still have conflicts. So self-cherishing isn't an affliction as such, but it is something that just means that all the afflictions can run rampant when we're dominated by it. So the opposite, cherishing others. So this one I also find very interesting because cherishing others means seeing the welfare of others as more important than one's own. And I thought, when push comes to shove, I'm like, oh yeah, we're all equal. Our welfare is equal. It seems reasonable, doesn't it? But that means in an extreme emergency, when push comes to shove, when we're equal, it's still me first. So the only way for it not to be me first is to actually take this attitude, you first. And then you're actually guarded from retaliating, from giving someone the finger or from the short remark because it's you first. So instead of having to make sure I don't accidentally give someone the finger, make sure I don't accidentally retaliate, make sure I don't do the whole list of things, you're just protected from doing all of those things. Just by this one attitude, others first. Because then, of course, we're going to take our own selves into consideration. That's our habit, but we also take others into consideration with this attitude. So for that, it's the door to all happiness. So here we are, we want happiness. There's nothing wrong with that. Actually, that's the whole point of Buddhism. Is to be happy, but to be able to cultivate lasting happiness. So this is a wise way to do it because just in the short term kind of retaliation or grabbing what you want or whatever, it doesn't last. So, what do you reckon? Questions, comments? How is that sitting? It's a bit, I mean, it's radical thinking. Difficult, yeah. It's thinking, that's right. So rather than
So if you were in traffic and you think,
it's stopping that negative thinking before it even arises. And actually, it's easier to do that because once the rage starts arising, you can't put it back in again. It's like your nervous system, your adrenal glands, like every you, sweat breaks out, it's already happened. You can't unhappen it. So what about if we do some prep so that when we leave the house, it's not going to arise? So that is intelligent selfishness. Better for you, better for your heart health, better for the car, better for everybody else. But yeah, it remains having a plan. Yes, failure to provide love and affection, especially to an abuser. So what we're talking about here is an attitude. So especially then when you're in abusive situations, physically, you've got to remove yourself from the situation. But in your heart, no. So it's the other way around from what we normally do. Normally, we can't move ourselves from the situation. So we stay in it and we close our heart. And who that harms, number one, is ourselves. It just destroys our good-heartedness. So I think what we find with an abuser is slowly, slowly do the practical thing, remove yourself from the situation, and then look at other examples. And when you look at other examples, you always find a backstory. And an abuser only abuses out of suffering. So that's how to begin. But it's a very good question. You can, that's right. You can take yourself without away without malice, but often. It often we rely on the energy of anger to make us move. Often we'll get ourselves out of an abusive situation only once we're galvanized by the force of retaliation. And that's terrible because we conflate, we think those two things are the same. And that the only way to get out of a terrible situation is through anger. And that's actually not true. It's the energy of anger that gets you out. Anger actually makes the situation worse. It's a very mixed bag. And that's why we burn out. That's why, in protests and things, everybody ends up shooting everybody, because of that. But I even notice it here, like even in a Dharma center, you're a volunteer, you work really, really hard, you start getting really tired. But you want to keep on working, and then it gets harder. And then it's like, oh, yeah, no one's going to come to that shift, so I've got to do it. Then you go, I can't do it anymore, and you leave. It's terrible. It takes that kind of reactive response to be able to do anything, and it's conflated with anger. And then we rely on anger to do anything about a bad situation. So you'll have to come to the rest of the classes when we're dealing with anger and aversion. Yeah, so there's a couple of examples that we can have of what's called intelligent selfishness, where one, for instance, I've heard say just about health systems, they've done a whole lot of studies with if you pour a lot of money into the most disadvantaged and vulnerable and the people with the worst health. That don't look after themselves, and you just blitz them with money. Even though it seems like, well, why? They just keep on making it worse for themselves. Why don't we be, equal and spread amongst everybody? If you do that, actually, you save billions of dollars later down the line. So it's like an investment in your society if you want. to actually save money, then you pour money into a section where you might think it's overdoing it. And that's why they say, you know, the measure of a society is how they treat the most vulnerable. Not because of some good-hearted looking after the vulnerable, but actually that's the way to make a sustainable society. It's just a logic thing. So that's kind of informed by this intelligent selfishness. And then, yeah, if you do it with good-heartedness, that's an added bonus. Then you feel happy about it, happy to support it. So a lot of the Scandinavian countries are like that, and I think that's easier because they're a much smaller population, and so you identify with everybody as yours, just errant members of the family. But it's still the family. It makes it one of the other, I think was Lithuania, no, Estonia, where Nokia comes from. So they're this tiny little country, only 1.2 million or something, the entire populace, and they're like, how are we going to hold our own in the world? So they just put pots of money into technology. We are going to train every single person in our culture how to be comfortable and love technology. And ta-da, they're like world leaders now. Tiny little population, you know, half the size of Brisbane. So again, it's in intelligent selfishness. Let's do a meditation on this. So, settling your posture, settling your mind. Our mind can be very busy, like a busy shopping center. So feel that the shops are finally quietening, the shelves are tidy, the bell at the door is quiet. And encourage an altruistic attitude for this meditation. Not only to make our own life feel lighter and steadier, but to be able to do so to focus on the welfare of others. When we're thinking about self-cherishing, the door to all suffering, like a Pandora's box. Cherishing others, the door to happiness. So, for instance, picture customer service. Putting others first leads to happy customers, happy workers, sustainable business. If we harm others to defend ourselves, does it truly protect anyone in the end? Retaliation rarely works, like correcting customers, even if we know we're right. What habit keeps repeating when we put our own comfort above others' well-being? It might be like a customer service worker cutting corners to rest, only to face more complaints later. Self-cherishing quietly fuels tension and dissatisfaction. Is this action truly protecting ourselves, or are we mistaking short-term defense for wisdom? So wise care and kindness looks at the long term, choosing strategies that reduce harm for everyone. Just like choosing good service values, creates lasting trust over being just right in the moment. If we pause and consider others first, what might happen to conflict in that moment? Our conflict reduces because caring attention interrupts the urge to retaliate. If we continue acting mainly for our own individual benefit, what kind of relationships does this create? They're likely to become strained and unstable, shaped by defense rather than trust. Like customers who feel unheard, people eventually stop returning. So over time, which succeeds more? Short-term selfish wins or patient caring strategy? So today, choose one ordinary interaction to practice patience and care with, even when you're tired. Remembering that cherishing others creates a wider good without neglecting yourself. Let this image of caring service to sentient beings gently sink into your awareness. A simple act of patience, planting peace for you and the wider world. So then, gently bring your focus back to the room. Now let's look at what bodhicitta actually is. So there is a definition. Buddhists are great with definitions. I heard this joke on the weekend. Christians believe in God and Buddhists believe in definitions. Put their trust in. So bodhicitta is the wish to become a Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings. So it's kind of like, if you want to become a doctor, why do you want to become a doctor? Someone wants to become a doctor, why? Save people, help people, that's right. So you want to become a doctor for a reason, isn't it? It's not like I became a doctor, stick the certificate up on the wall, the end, they lived happily ever after. No, when you become a doctor, it's the beginning of the story. So this bodhicitta is the wish to become a Buddha. Why? To be able to perfectly benefit all sentient beings. So it's the beginning of the story, being able to really help, have everything at your disposal to be able to perfectly help. So it's a twofold aspiration. This wish, the principal wish, got to become a Buddha. Why? To benefit all sentient beings, the supporting aspiration. If only the life was easy as that, just turn on the on switch. Bodhicitta is often represented over here in the Chenrezig Tanki. You can see Chenrezig with his hands at his heart holds a jewel. It's the jewel of bodhicitta. It represents this wish. It also represents the clear nature of our mind that means it is possible to become a Buddha. So that's why it's there at the heart. So this attitude, then everything that we do is flavored by this attitude. So they say that bodhicitta can even become a main mind, like the driver that drives everything. When you get up, when you go to work, when you have a conversation, when you watch TV, when you're helping people, when you're bored, you can do everything with bodhicitta. It's like everything feeds into this. It becomes like a really instinctual driver. So I've met people where their instinctual driver is something else. It's been they just want to be famous. And everything is flavored by that. Everything they do, they're thinking, oh, I could stick this on Instagram, blah, blah, blah. They're not even doing the things that they're doing. They're just thinking about fame. So what if we just were driven by bodhicitta, this incredible wish? So this kind of points out then that there are common misconceptions. Bodhicitta isn't an emotional state. It's much more than that because emotions go up and down. And you can be depressed with bodhicitta. You can be anxious with bodhicitta. So when I get anxious, then I think I'm going to experience my anxiety for everybody. I'm going to be the designated anxieter. Everybody in the room who's anxious and socially uncomfortable, I'm just going to take it all on me. I'll do it so you can be relaxed. To the extent that you all think I'm extroverted, right? No. It's the thing that I've learned. It's actually helped me. So now I'm not terrified of you. But when I first started leading Tuesday nights, I called them my torture Tuesdays. Because I was so shy and so terrified. And really the only way around it was to just go, no, I'm gonna do this with the bodhicitta motivation. I'm gonna do it for you. I'll take it on, I'll do it for you. So it's not just an emotional state like feeling good or feeling warm-hearted or liking people. That's kind of a result of bodhicitta. But it's much more than just an emotion. And like I was saying before, it's not an overwhelming burden that paralyzes us. If that's how we begin to feel about it, then we're missing a piece of the puzzle. It's more like what you really couldn't be bothered doing for yourself, you would put in the effort for others. And it's also not that we can't do anything until then. So unlike becoming a doctor, if you started practicing as a doctor before you had your certificate, you'd be in trouble. But all the way along, we can start trying to develop bodhicitta. We can practice straight away. It's going to benefit ourselves and others. And probably I can add in also, it's not just a religious thing. It's because it's based on this intelligent selfishness. It's how to actually have a peaceful society. It's just taking the social engagement and the eco engagement to its ultimate. So far, so good. Questions, comments? There's a lot that goes into wishing to become a Buddha because we've got to understand the nature of mind and what a Buddha is and if it's possible and if it's possible for us here in Brisbane. In the 21st century, all of those things. So I'm just kind of putting it out there to get us started. What bodhicitta is based on is equanimity, a foundation of equanimity. Without equanimity, there's no bodhicitta. So even if we don't get bodhicitta straight away, we can all get this equanimity. So when we relate to people. Normally, I think the term these days is transactional. All our relationships are transactional. All this stuff that they talk about, some are and some aren't, bollocks. Every single one of them is because it's based on if people are kind to us, we feel kindly towards them. It's just, and if they're aggressive towards us, we're frightened, we get defensive. But what happens is what that is behavior, isn't it? How someone treats us, then we think that's them as an entire human being. So if a little kid comes up to me and whacks me and then runs off, I'm like, evil child, isn't it? Because I'm judging the child by their one few seconds of behavior. When we look at our relationships with others, we think our friend is our friend because they are good, and our enemy is our enemy because they are bad. And that's actually a mistake. What makes them a friend or an enemy is our relationship with them. Because it doesn't even stand up to logic, because our friend could be somebody else's enemy. When people break up, divorce, who ends up friends and enemies? It's really tricky, isn't it? Because how can you be your friend and how can you be friends with both parties when somebody's got to be right and somebody wrong? So what equanimity is, isn't a flat line. It's not just feeling neutral. It's quite different from that. It is actually feeling equally drawn towards everybody without favoritism or fear. Equally kindly towards people. Equally affectionate towards all people. So it's raised the bar. It's not just, well, I don't feel anything for anybody. It's actually feeling friendly towards others, regardless of how we get on or not. It does take a while, and I've come at it through reasoning. Because you're still going to get on with people or not, but there are people that I don't get on with that they don't even know. And that's okay. And I don't have to spend all my time with them, but I can think about them and their life and care. It's just that we don't get on. But we make this big deal about getting on. Actually, it's really fickle because who cares whether I get on with them or not? Heaps of other people do. And even with the most despicable people. You think their mother cared about them. Their children would be devastated if their mum or dad died. You think about any given politician. They're not a politician to their kids. How can you wish that kind of suffering on their kids? So it takes a bit of thinking, a bit of work to equalize people. And then we come to this thing of, oh, yeah, I have this judgment of them. Because of how they relate to me. It's so egocentric, isn't it? Yeah, that's right. So self-righteousness is like halfway there. Because in self-righteousness or self-justification or righteous anger, all of those things, is a recognition that harm is being done and no one should behave like this. And that's true. But then, without even noticing, we go, therefore, that person is bad. And then we don't like the person. But actually, this is where it can be so fraught, say with families. If our family member is being despicable, now we're really challenged, aren't we? Because we love our family member and yet they're acting despicable. So we want to say they're bad. But then hang on a second, they're my family. No one talks to my family like that, la, la, la. So it challenges us. So there's this conflation between the person and their behavior, and it is so deeply instinctual because this is what we call appearances. People appear bad from their own side, or they appear good from their own side, and we just believe the appearances. So heaps of people get sucked in by scams and things because someone's in a suit and has good teeth. Oh, must be legit. And that's why it happens, because the appearances, or well, they're kind. But what it is, they're just acting kind. So It's one way is to recognize there's the behavior and the person. The other is to recognize that whatever relationships we have, that's how we judge people. So let's look at the relationship and try and improve the quality of the relationship. So yes, distinguish between the person and our relationship with them. And it's the positive relationships that bring happiness. And actually, the real enemy isn't out there. The real enemy is hatred or othering people. That's the real enemy. So Lama Yeshe says there are three objects in our meditation: friends, enemies, and strangers. How do such labels arise? Because we are so preoccupied with ourselves, with our me, we become very attached to our body, possessions, comforts, friends. Anyone who interferes with these or threatens our happiness is immediately labeled enemy. Likewise, if someone does something to increase our happiness, he or she quickly becomes a friend. And as for strangers, they are those who give us neither help nor harm, and we therefore tend to ignore them completely. The foundation of equilibrium meditation is to see how senseless and disadvantageous it is for us to make such distinctions. The attitudes of hatred, attachment, and closed-minded ignorance that arise in us when we view others in terms of these fixed labels are highly detrimental to ourselves and others. The wish to destroy enemies and defend friends has been the cause of all of the conflicts in the world, from squabbles between two individuals to global war. All this negative karma and suffering would come to an end if everyone could see how baseless such partisanship is. First of all, we must realize that attachment is at the root of all judgments we make regarding enemy, friend, and stranger. We are attached either to threatened possessions, people who've helped us, or our own ignorant view of who's important to our well-being. So this is also something to put to you about how important equanimity is, which is about even if we are compassionate, good-hearted, we have to be careful of our compassion that it's not biased. Because if our compassion is biased or partisan, it leads to conflict. Even compassion leads to conflict. And this I find deeply unsettling. So, what we're used to is what in Buddhist terminology is called mere compassion, ordinary compassion, which is what we have for someone or something that we see as suffering and that matters to us. Everybody has compassion for somebody, even if it's just their pet, you know. Everyone has, but it's because it's not for everybody, it becomes biased. And if we have compassion for ours, me and mine, my family, and someone comes to harm my family, and we have that partisanship, what happens? We retaliate. I mean, entire wars are fought because people are defending their people. They're willing to put their life on the line to defend their people. But because it's biased, it creates more conflict. So, again, it's easy to have compassion for friends, for me and mine, and really difficult to have compassion and care for one's enemies, even to the extent that we can't even hear it. What? Compassion for my enemies? What? How's that even possible? So, how do you reckon we do that? How do we find compassion for enemies? Where do we start? Realizing they're afflicted too? Yep. Everybody has a story. Separate the person from the behavior. What about how do we start feeling kind-hearted towards them? Forgiveness? Well, forgiveness comes as a process of going, they couldn't help it, basically. We can see their backstory. But one of the biggest ways is to find common ground. So, one lady who was here, she's like, This lady, she ran away with my husband stealer, hate her guts. It's like, well, what do you have in common? Nothing. It's like, you both like the same fella for starters. But not only that, so she's like that, like really shocked. Oh my gosh. Same generation, same era, same kind of age of becoming invisible, same teenage children that were really rude to them. Like all of these things, suddenly, oh my gosh. But for the husband stealing episode, we're like the same. So, yeah, you may not necessarily end up being besties, though often it does happen, doesn't it? All the exes become good friends. But it stops the hatred, and you can have really legitimate compassion for someone that you understand like that, that actually isn't biased by them being your friend. Actually, it's more pure. So, great compassion, capital G, great compassion is impartial because it encompasses everybody. And so, yes, you find common ground with enemies. That's how you start developing it. What do you have in common? You diminish attachment to friends. That's the other thing. So instead of being attached to friends, you just try not to hurt them. And normally with our friends, we want them to do fun stuff with us. We hardly ever think about if we're hurting them or not. So we try and be less attached. And with strangers, try and raise the bar instead of just being willing to be neutral. Because when we're neutral, people don't matter again. There's nothing stopping us harming them. So you try and find something in common, and now suddenly they become me and my people, till everybody's me and my people. Part of finding commonality too is I just personally feel to try and relate to individuals rather than groups. Because once you start groups, now they're not people anymore. But if an individual in there and you find out their story or you get to know or you have a conversation, suddenly you might still hate the group, but oh, here's an exception. And then eventually that group will dissolve, won't be an other anymore. So this is challenging, isn't it? But we can see how important it's imperative that we do it. If we want world peace, this is the only way to do it. Because we're not going to get on with everybody. Doesn't matter, don't have to. Just need humanity. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama often talks about how he thinks of everybody as his brothers and sisters, just some he can't quite remember. But that's his starting point, brothers and sisters. It's so nice when Geshe Zopa comes to teach and he says, "Good evening, brothers and sisters," and suddenly you go, "Oh, everybody feels welcome just by that, being treated like that." So we've got to start with mere compassion. We've got to start with where we genuinely feel compassion, authentic care, concern, wishing others to be, free of suffering. And then we've got to use our reasoning and logic and expand it to everybody. And then we'll be safe. But if we just leave it at that good-hearted feeling, it's going to backfire. Let's do one more reflection. Okay, so again, nice deep breath. Bring your focus inwards. Let out any stale air from the lungs. And imagine that you're in a beautiful park, sitting comfortably on a park bench, enjoying the view. Your mind calming down, reflecting the spaciousness around you. Set your intention to benefit the vastness of living beings. Starting right here with our daily relationships. So, how do we learn to meet people without the weight of preference? to relate beyond habit or expectation or avoidance. So as we're sitting on our lovely park bench, we see three people approaching us along the path. A long-term close friend, a work adversary, and their unknown companion. So ask yourself, who do I lean toward? Our heart naturally opens to the friend with our shared experience and interests. But there are many things that are a mystery to us about them. Is it really the person themselves? Or is it the positive relationship that creates this ease and joy? And then the person you may not have even noticed. Casually indifferent to the companion, we may feel naturally open because we don't even have any history with them. Do you respond differently once you know a little more about them? How would you feel if you discovered you went to the same school? Love the same obscure music, have the same type of dog, go to the same Buddhist center. Notice your feelings changing. And then lastly, who do you resist? You might feel yourselves tense up at the old adversary. But as they approach you, they greet you warmly. They apologize for past hurt and genuinely inquire after your well-being. So, what creates the distance? Expectations and projections distort our relationships. We carry our stories well past their use-by date. How might becoming aware of their backstory change how we feel? How would compassion guide you? And who are you beyond reactions? Awareness itself. Judgments loosen and curiosity replaces certainty. An open heart naturally responds wisely rather than reacts automatically. So decide to experiment with an even-minded kindness towards others. Ask yourself, What would His Holiness say? How would the Dalai Lama greet these people? And conclude by appreciating your sincere effort, how this feeds into creating global harmony, starting right here with yourselves. And so with this dedication, then again, bring your focus back to the room. Okay, so Lama Yeshe says about bodhicitta, even without an actual realization of bodhicitta, if we possess a similar selfless attitude or altruistic attitude, it will eventually lead to this higher motive and in the process be very beneficial for our practice. Therefore, whether we're helping people, reciting texts, burning incense, or merely eating, talking, or engaging in business, whatever we're doing becomes an essential Dharma practice if we dedicate it toward our attainment of enlightenment for the sake of others. So in terms of how do we develop bodhicitta, the really big-hearted attitude, there's a couple of methods, and one is called six causes and one effect. So the six causes are like the step-by-step progression, the one effect, bodhicitta. And this is the easy one to do. There is another one called equalizing and exchanging oneself with others, which is much harder because it's really putting ourselves in others' shoes and seeing others are many and we are one, and that takes a lot more. This is easier because it's a lot more emotional. So this is the progression. The first one is this one of recognizing all living beings, all sentient beings, have been our mother. So this means that all sentient beings, if we've had beginningless lifetimes, we've had relationships with every single living being at some stage. They've been our very best friend. They've been our mother, our guardian, our teacher, our besties. So this is like a mathematical understanding. And this is why we do the rebirth class earlier on, because if we don't have a grasp on past and future lives, on this continuity of mind, this step's very difficult. There is kind of a plan B that we might think, oh, everybody is somebody's beloved son or daughter. Everybody matters to somebody, therefore they matter, whether it's not just to me. Or we stand on the shoulders of giants, you know, of all those gone before. So we have this kind of understanding of this connectedness that we have with every single living being. So the t-shirt would be, been there, done that, everybody's been my mother. You know, everybody's looked after me, sacrificed their life for me at some stage. Of course, in the West, we have trouble with the word mother, don't we? Lots of people. So then everyone's been your bestie. Everyone's been your most treasured friend, your supporter, your benefactor. So then, once you've got this big picture of all the sentient beings, then you recall the kindness. So you can take the opposite and go, well, what if you thought everybody's been my enemy? How would you start feeling about people then? Terrible. So you'd start recalling all of it, and so your whole life would collapse in. So no, let's think everybody's been incredibly kind to me at some stage, and so you recall the kindness. And I'll put a little picture here of a Chook with the chickens, because not only humans, but when I was a little baby chicken, Mother Chook looked after me. When I was a kitten, the mother cat looked after me. I've seen animals, how they look after their young. They selfless. They go without eating, without drinking. They give their lives, and they're animals, you know. So the kindness that is shown, wow, in all these past lives that we've had. So you think about the kindness until you start going, wow. And so then the natural progression is this wish, how can I repay you? Just like when someone doesn't helps you out, when someone lends you money, how can I repay you? Thank you so much. Or someone cooks you dinner, or someone picks you up when all the buses and trains have stopped and it's too late and you missed the last one and they come and get you in the pouring rain. He's like, how can I repay you? This, it's a genuine feeling, isn't it? It's not feeling obligated, it's just this real genuine wish to repay. And so then, this one is closely associated with, leads to great loving kindness. So when you wish to repay, the wish is you want them to be happy, you want good things to happen to them, you want everything that they need, that they get everything that they need, that they have all the success in life. Like you have this big-hearted wish. Great loving kindness. So loving kindness is a really nice practice. It's inherently joyful. It's a nice thing to all the things that you'd like to do for people. You can, it's a lovely thing to daydream about. But this, if you notice, capital G, great loving kindness. So that means for everybody. Including the politicians, including the landlords. So the wishing to repay the kindness, wishing them happiness, not just our friends. So these are the great loving kindness meditations are ones that are really good to do when you start thinking of the just the kindness of strangers, the kindness of you. I mean, I look at the traffic because you know my driving history, right? And I just think it's amazing that there aren't more smashes. It's amazing that there isn't more road rage. The fact that the majority stick by the rules, it's kindness. It takes effort. And everybody is doing that for strangers. And yeah, it's in our own best interest, but also it's because we do naturally, when we're neutral, care about others. And actually, all of the road rage and accidents and mistakes and things happen when people aren't at their best. So you start thinking about the kindness of others and wishing to repay, and then feeling, you know, great love towards them. And then the next one, great compassion. So this is where you go, well, oh my gosh, how can people actually have this happiness and be happy when there's so much suffering in the world, where they've got all these problems? So from great love, wishing others to be happy, comes great compassion, wishing them to be free of suffering. So these definitions are great in Buddhism. What is love? Wishing others to be happy. It's so simple. What's compassion? Wishing others to be free of suffering. But when we meditate on compassion, it's more difficult, isn't it? Why? Because we're focusing on suffering, and that hurts. So, actually, developing compassion, we've got to be careful how we do it, that we don't just focus on all the suffering of everybody and just become overwhelmed and shut down. That's more like empathy. What compassion is an activity, wishing others to be free of suffering. And so great compassion is wishing everybody to be free of suffering. So within that, you see, because Often we conflate compassion and empathy as the same thing. They're not the same thing. So empathy is the feeling. Compassion is, may you be free of suffering. And to develop great compassion, then you can contemplate all the different realms, the animal realms, the human realms, all the different states of humans, all the unseen realms, the ghosts, the hell beings, the gods, all of these, and it can be really distressing. I mean, I can't even watch nature documentaries. I'm in bits. I just can't do it. And also because for anybody to live, the others have to die. So you have the lions chasing the antelope. Who are you barracking for? Can't watch it. I just can't do it. It's just too horrible. I mean, as a child, I loved all the David Attenborough movies, but now, and I was very heartened to hear when Lama Zsopa Rinpoche apparently is at one of the hotels, and they were on one of his world tours, and David Attenborough doco was playing on the TV, and Rinpoche was there, like behind the door, peeking, going, "Oh no!" And they're crying, and they're looking, and they're looking back again. I'm like, yeah, even Rinpoche is like just heartbroken. So this is the thing. It's like that, you know. We have to great loving kindness is barracking for both the antelope and the lion, and seeking how. So what do we do? We think I have to help all sentient beings. So we get to step six, which is this highest intention of it becomes everybody's suffering becomes unbearable to us. And then we think, I can't let it for one more moment stand like this. I can't let people suffer like this for one more moment. I've got to do something. So this is where great compassion begins to have this sense of like universal responsibility. I can't just go, oh, I'll do something about it after I have a cup of tea. Because all the way back there, it's like if your best friend and your family was in the burning house and you're walking past, oh, hang on a minute, I just got to do this thing. I'll just finish this email and then I'll save you. It's like, no, you drop everything and you run in to help. And people do, don't they? And then in the news they say, oh, anybody would have. I'm just an ordinary person. And it's true because ordinary people have this naturally in their heart to, when they see suffering, to help. You know, unless we're obstructed by various afflictions or illness or whatever, that's the natural thing to do. So this highest intention, you think, not just I've got to help the people in the burning house or the people in this country, but I've got to help the people in that country as well. All the people in the army that are attacking this country that are all being conscripted in, as well as everybody that they're attacking, everybody, even the ones that are ordering the hits. It's got to be, it's everybody. And then you think, I've got it. Can't wait around for somebody else. Who else? Oh my, so I often think I'm going to be the reluctant bodhisattva because it's like, oh no, it's got to be me. I mean, that's why I'm here at Luwri Tonka Center, because who am I to try and like run a Buddhist center and lead Buddhist classes? But it's like, oh my gosh, like nobody else has stepped up. It's got to be me. Sorry, everybody. So you have this highest intention, and then you think, but what can me, as a little 6-year-old, what can I do? What can we do just as people in Brisbane? Very little, probably more than a whole lot of other people around the world, but still very little. We don't have that much power. And even if we did have power, do we have an understanding of all the different varied people of how to help them? So then you go, what would I have to do to be able to perfectly understand everybody's mind and know how to help them? What kind of person could do that? A Buddha! Oh my gosh! I've got to become a Buddha! So that is bodhicitta. I've got to become a Buddha to be able to perfectly benefit all sentient beings, lead them out of suffering and into lasting happiness. Do you get it? Do you get So this is the natural progression. So this is how you meditate on bodhicitta, developing bodhicitta. You actually develop it. And you do it again and again and again until it becomes second nature. And then you go out and catch the bus and do whatever. And then whatever you do, it's going to benefit others. Even if you're sitting at home meditating, it's still going to benefit others, the whole lot. So, last questions, comments? Pauline, Bodhisattva Pauline, how are you going? Selfishness, just because it's a habit, comes up. But we forget, so that's why we had the meditation class, caring for the mind. So we start off reminding ourselves, don't leave the house without bodhicitta.
I think intention. I've got to work on that afternoon.
Which one? The
Intention.
intention, the highest intention. Yeah, because then with this intention, then we can go out and do all the social justice and everything, and we'll do what we can. And when we come up against the limitations of our society, we won't become cynical and jaded. We'll just go, oh, there's the limitation. We won't burn out. This is what makes it sustainable. We'll be able to keep going. And even for, like, I know many first responders that have burnt out after how many years of service, and then just something breaks. And it's because the whole thing was built on something that is not sustainable and that is built on an external response. And once you see that many more people die than live, you give up. So this gives an even bigger picture, makes it really sustainable.
Saving cockroaches and that.
Saving, that's right. Well, just even if you can't save them, to recognize that they're our brothers and sisters. So they matter. That's the thing.
Getting a job.
That's right. You
Your
can't
job's
save everybody, and
saving.
it's not your job.
Yes.
But to have that feeling and
It's
not be
sitting there saying
overwhelmed,
stress.
it's the intention. So when something really matters to us, we go in, we don't think, oh, is this possible? Am I going to be able to save them from the burning house? Let me see now. We don't know, but that's not the point. The point is this real impetus to just give it your best shot. And I think once we start getting stuck back in the I'm an ordinary person, you're an ordinary person, and I've succeeded or failed, it's collapsed back down again, and that's where we lose our impetus. So it's a really big, big picture, this one, in all ways. Big-hearted, big because of all the sentient beings, big because of the scope of past lives, now and future generations. Like everything about it is big. But the other thing about this is that it's that big that it can sustain us.
Yeah, and it's really important that you have the connection to do.
Yeah,
If you
because
don't
you're
have
a
it, you
sentient
can't.
being
If you
too.
don't have it, you can't do it.
Yes,
Yeah,
if you don't
so it'll
have, if
become
you
unwell.
can't recognize your own suffering and feel for yourself, there's no way you can feel for others. Yeah. That's right. So I kind of feel, say, with the self-care thing, like, it kind of makes my skin crawl because it's there, yes, self-care, but it stops at self-care. It doesn't go, why self-care? Why do we care for ourselves? It's not for ourselves. It's for the entire humanity and all the living creatures on the earth and beyond. That's why. But it's still, yeah, self-care. So actually, in a way, a whole lot of the Buddhist teachings is ultimate self-care. Like this.
Just a couple of comments.
Oh,
What you're saying is kind of mind-blowing in a good way.
yeah. A mind-blowing in a good way.
Yeah. And
Excellent.
then Ashley saying.
Ah, yes. So don't forget, there is the physical approach of a person who might be an abuser, and there is our attitude. So an abuser, you think of as like a brutalized guard dog. You're not going to approach them with love and affection and give them a cuddle. You're going to approach them with defensive moves, but it won't be with hate. It'll be with understanding, and you can still work for the benefit of liberating that abused guard dog from that torturous situation that they're in. But it may not be you that does the hugging and the cuddling. In fact, the best way to liberate brutalized guard dogs is to put them in with a pack of other well-adjusted dogs, and the dogs rehabilitate the abused one. Really interesting. So in amongst your own people, that's how you, but you can be a helper to facilitate that. So often we get mixed up between intention and then what we can do. So the intention is big. What we can do is limited, but that's okay. So without equanimity, there's a danger our compassion leads to conflict. So to really work every day on this equanimity to equalize out. And then develop this cherishing others. So if in doubt, me first or you first, it's you first. And that way everybody's safe. And with bodhicitta, everything becomes possible. This is how the Buddha became enlightened. And this is how not just the Buddha, but many people became enlightened. And this is how, with this, even just an altruistic approach, people manage to move heaven and earth, helping others while still staying kind. So, yeah, we could put ourselves in others' shoes and just go, yep, they're just like me. So just before we dedicate, so during the week, be kind to those you don't like. Simples. And how to do that? Recognize existential suffering. They're suffering, just like me. His Holiness the Dalai Lama always says, be kind whenever possible. It is always possible. and so then next week we're going into the nature of reality. Oh, my gosh. What's called emptiness, ultimate bodhicitta, dependent arising, and what does this mean for me? So this is the big picture of how our wisdom sustains our compassion and loving kindness. So go more into that. Okay, let's dedicate. So we can be really pleased that we spent our effort like this and developing the biggest possible attitude for the biggest possible benefit for ourselves and all beings. So we dedicate for our own enlightenment so we can perfectly and effortlessly help all living beings out of their suffering and into lasting happiness. And as we dedicate, we can do so with a confidence that this is possible because of the pure nature of our mind and the ultimately pure nature of every single living being. And so not only is it worth it, but it's also possible.